doing content suggestions on this.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Stuart. First of all, my apologies to Cedar Sinai's new logo. Next time I have to make sure to use that. I want to, first of all, thank Stuart. So this presentation is also part of an assignment for me. I'm completing a doctorate right now in clinical bioethics. My focus is not to do the same work that Andy and Virginia and Stuart do in terms of bioethics here at the hospital, but to do what I'm going to talk about today, which is to try to apply Jewish law and how to be the best resource possible to patients who are struggling with Jewish values and Jewish law as they apply to contemporary issues. And I chose a topic today that for this semester, and this, you know, the culmination of this is to hopefully publish this and to give this presentation. The topic that I chose is the topic that I get asked most frequently by staff here at the hospital. So I do want to just first acknowledge my professors for this. My professor was Nanette Elster at Loyola University of Chicago, and my advisor for this was Kahan Parsi. And Stuart Finder read the first draft and gave very, very insightful feedback. That was very helpful to me. And also Paul Van Gelder, who reads every single thing that I write always. I was unfortunate not to be here today, but acknowledges him. So as I was mentioning, this topic is the most frequently asked issue that I deal with staff here at the hospital, and I'll explain why. Conscientious objection is also referred to as conscientious refusal. That might be a phrase that you've heard, and it's a common phrase that's been used in history, whether it is physicians who refuse to comply with unethical regimes such as abusive Nazi medicine, or whether it's in reference to military refusal. There's been, for hundreds of years, there have been people, especially people from pacifist religions, who have refused to participate in military efforts. Oftentimes, they were killed for refusing to participate. But military conscientious objection is a common thing. I mean, during the Vietnam War here in the United States, that was something common. In America today, what I found in the literature and in our experience, the most common issues that people, that staff object to being part of for moral or religious reasons, that's what we mean by conscious objection. People refuse to take part in these, even though they are legal and they are happening in the hospitals or in their place of practice, they refuse to take part are things like euthanasia, not legal in America, but there are places where it's legal, physician aid in dying, also referred to as physician assisted suicide, sometimes donation after cardiac death, organ donation, something that's also referred to as palliative sedation, contraception, reproductive technologies, and more recently, gene editing. It's most commonly practiced, at least in the literature in particular, those who object most frequently are doctors, nurses, and pharmacists, as we will discuss. Now, when this became a major issue in the United States was after 1973. 1973, Roe versus Wade, abortion becomes legal in the United States, and that led to Congress passing, shortly afterwards, what became called the Church Amendment. Now, it's interesting, it's not called the Church Amendment because there was a church that passed it, or because it was meant for people that go to church. It was actually a person whose last name was Church, a congressman named Church, who said, you know, if abortion is going to be legal, we have to be able to not take part in it if we feel, those who feel that it is morally problematic. So it was a response to the legalization of abortion in the United States, and it was meant to protect people from discrimination from their employers, or ensure that no one would ever be required to take part in procedures that they thought were unethical. It's constantly changing based on who the president is. In terms of the law stands, but in terms of how it's enforced, how broadly it's enforced, and it's obviously something that's being talked about a lot today because it's being enforced, meaning rights to object are being permitted in more and more categories today, and it's leading to lots and lots of controversy. So what I want to do now is discuss those who argue, starting from a secular perspective, we're going to get into the Jewish discussion momentarily, but why those who argue that we should have this right to object to procedures that we find, that one finds immoral, what's their argument? Why do they think that should be, one should object and not take part in them? Then we want to look at the response, because this is a very conscientious issue. I meant that intentionally. But it's very, that was Stuart's title. You kind of take the conscientiousness out of the conscientious, I can't say it. But it's very hotly debated. And what are those who argue against it? They make very strong arguments as well. There's some compromise approaches. And then I want to share a Jewish approach that I find very important. So we'll do it. I'll try to make it through slowly, but also I'm going to save time for discussion at the end. Here are some of the arguments that have been made in favor of the importance of having conscientious objection. Now, first of all, I did say it's not only religious people. There are those who have moral struggles with issues that's not about religion. But there are those who argue that we have a right to freedom of religion in our country, and part of the freedom to practice religion should mean that I shouldn't be forced to engage in things that violate my religion. Others argue that, you know, we live in a multicultural society, and we should have a tolerant society, and therefore it's important to accept different moral viewpoints and have a sort of respect for moral diversity. And it's important, just like we all know that diversity is important in a workforce, because then you have different perspectives and different ideas, so too diversity of moral perspectives. And if you allow people to object, therefore you can allow all kinds of people to be part of the healthcare system, even those who have struggles with certain interventions. Others argue that there's a need for sort of humility, ethical humility. Like, we don't always know what's right. Things sometimes change. How can I be so dogmatic to say that other viewpoints are wrong, and therefore someone else doesn't want to engage in a procedure, even though I think it should be allowed? I should allow them not to engage in that procedure. That's sort of humility in allowing different viewpoints. There's also some concern that if we don't allow people to conscientiously object to participate in certain procedures, that would be a sort of discrimination or violation of their human rights, because we are forcing people to go against their convictions, and that can be problematic. Also, the right to object is part of democracy. We know that we believe in people's ability to right to protest, to speak out. If there's something they don't like, they shouldn't say it. And the truth is, we'll get to this soon, but this is part of people's ethical education. You know, a lot of the biggest challenges happen with residents because they're experiencing different areas of healthcare, even those that they might not choose to take part in professionally in the long term. Should they have the right to speak out when they see things that trouble them when they are learning about the healthcare system? And democracy, just like avoiding military service for those who have objection, this avoids discrimination. Finally, there are those who argue that, you know, there's a right to autonomy, and just like people have the autonomous right to engage in procedures, which others might think are immoral, so too those who don't want to assist with them should be allowed to withdraw themselves. And in general, this also impacts people's employment, and therefore we should respect people's freedom of choice, both, to engage in procedures that are legal and to not help with those procedures. But the argument that I think is the strongest, or at least that's quoted most frequently in the literature, is what's called moral integrity, protecting practitioners' moral integrity. And the argument basically goes that healthcare practitioners are not technicians. It's not like being an auto mechanic and I'm not nothing against auto mechanics. I once actually built a car. I like cars. But the point is, it's much more, you know, mechanical. It's very specific about what you can do and what you don't do. It's not as artistic, so to speak, as the practice of healthcare. And so their argument is, healthcare professionals are not to be just mechanics, they need to be able to be true to themselves and to be able to practice in a way that is true with their values. And if they're forced to go against their values, it will cause moral distress, lack of self-respect, it can lead to burnout, fatigue, exhaustion, and it impacts their ability to be a responsible moral agent. And we want practitioners who are honest and trustworthy, and this promotes the common good. We have examples, for example, in healthcare where medical students were asked to engage in practices that were common, for example, practicing on corpses that had not given their consent to be used in medical education. And we have a few examples of medical schools where the students objected and said, you know, these people didn't consent to this and they don't know we're doing this. Isn't this problematic? And they're able to stop that. Also, some animal experimentation that medical students objected to and then had policies changed. Don't we benefit in society by having people have the right to say when they don't think something is right and to object to it? So the argument is that this not only protects the moral integrity of practitioners, but it actually increases ethical sensitivity in our society and helps ensure that physicians and those practicing medicine are earning the social trust and that our society is the better for it. Those are arguments in favor of conscientious objection in the secular literature today. How about arguments against? I don't know why it goes from the bottom up. How about those who argue against? There are many who feel that there should not be a right to object, to participate in any procedure that's legal and professionally accepted. And what they call this is the incompatibility thesis. They say simply, if someone is incompatible to do their job and to practice in their profession, they should not be allowed to object. People voluntarily join their profession, they're expected to serve society, and it's not the same as military service, they argue, because it's voluntary. And the main interest of healthcare professionals should be the patients. It should be patient-centered care and what's best for their patients. We choose to go into this field, and therefore, if we're not willing to participate in some procedures, we should not practice medicine, especially if that's our specialty. This is called the compatibility thesis, and they disagree with all the arguments that I put forward in favor of conscientious objection. They also make a very strong and compelling point about, you know, much of conscientious objection is about what I'm not willing to do. So this we call, the bottom point there, negative duties. I'm not willing to assist with an abortion procedure or a physician aid in dying. I think that's wrong, and I'm not willing to do it. What about positive duties? There are those who say, well, actually, my desire or my willingness to assist a patient with something that's legal and professionally accepted is a positive duty. I want to help people who are otherwise marginalized or suffering, and I'm going out on a limb and risking myself, sometimes physically, to provide a procedure for someone that you are morally objecting to, and by protecting conscientious objection, you're now stigmatizing my behavior and undermining my virtue in helping people to receive treatments that other people are objecting to. So they feel strongly that conscientious objection actually is damaging to society. And moreover, I think their strongest claim is actually a social justice concern. The concern goes as follows. Basically, if conscientious objection is allowed, and it's allowed on a very broad basis, then what happens when you have people who live in rural areas, people who are poor, people who have limited health insurance options, people who live in areas where their only access is to a faith-based institution or a public hospital that is now not willing to provide services that they need? Their argument is that this is going to cause unnecessary burdens on patients and actually compromise their health care. It will compromise it because it causes health care to be inconsistent. So their treatment depends on the values of their healthcare team. It's inefficient because now they have to go searching for a doctor. In the literature, there's lists of like entire regions of the country where people are unable to access certain interventions, and it's not so easy to simply fly somewhere else or travel long distances, especially when someone is sick and poor and in need. And so the concern is that this disproportionately impacts those who are poor and those who are most in need of these services, and there's a potential for discrimination whether, and misuse of this right, whether it's based on race or sexual orientation or morality, that this discrimination can become kind of a snowball and can become worse and worse the more it, this right is allowed. So those are the arguments for and against conscientious objection in the secular literature today. And when I mean today, it's hot. There's lots of articles being published. Just last week, there's an entire journal of theoretical bioethics. The entire journal was dedicated to this topic, and it's constantly being debated. What are some of the solutions? If people, I hope you can see that, just I'm kind of going through quickly because I want to make my point about the Jewish point in a second, but you can see that these, on both sides, they make very strong cases, and they believe very strongly in the correctness of their views and the essentiality, if that's a word, of their position. And so they really butt heads. I mean, they both really think the other is wrong. How can you deny me of my right to object? Others say, how can you put patients in danger when you went into medicine? So what are some of the solutions? Some say, well, you should limit those who are allowed to object. Some say there should actually be tests of genuineness. Is someone really religious? Is this really part of their religion? And some even argue that even if it's part of their religion, they should be able to make a rational defense of it. Just saying that my religion doesn't allow this is not enough. You should be able to rationally defend why you object to this and why your religion goes against it. This comes up in all kinds of areas, not just the very controversial ones I mentioned, but vaccination is an example where this happens, especially every winter. It also should make sure to avoid any negative impact on quality, efficiency, and equitability of healthcare. So this might mean, some have suggested, healthcare providers or clinics who are not willing to perform certain interventions should pay for the costs when the patients have to go elsewhere to find those interventions. They should offer emergency life-saving services when no alternative is available. They should clearly inform patients or employers who are being hired of what services they won't perform, and they should never obstruct access to healthcare and should respectfully provide other options and timely referrals. And at the very least, that would be a compromise that could make more comfortable with allowing conscientious objection. So this, briefly, is an overview of what's happening in general bioethical debate. Any initial comments, questions, reactions to this first part of our discussion? Okay, there's going to be a lot more to talk about. So what I want to do now is try to make a claim. And my claim here is not, I'm not talking only to Jews in this case. My claim is, you know, since many who believe in conscientious objection and say people should not be required to engage in interventions that they feel are morally problematic. Since, even though I try to make clear that it's not only about religion, some people have moral, ethical reasons that have nothing to do with religion, but since much of it comes from religious perspectives, I want to try to share a perspective that comes out of Judaism that I think can inform this debate and that I didn't find in any of the literature. And it's also somewhat new and controversial, put it that way. I don't mean to be controversial. Meaning, let me say it this way. It's new in that the person who I'm going to be relying on, who initially gave a lecture here, Rabbi Usher Weiss, who gave this lecture here, that kind of inspired me to start thinking about this, has published it, but it hasn't even actually been published yet. He's just written it. And not everyone agrees. That's the way I meant to say it. So it's just one perspective that I want to share that I think can inform this debate. And I'm going to slow down for this part because I want to make it very clear. So the first part of what has to become clear to have this discussion is one point about Jewish law, which is that when we make a decision about how to determine what Jewish law says about a given intervention, we have to figure out which category of Jewish law or biblical verse does this issue fall under, and is it a biblical issue or is it rabbinic, meaning the Bible, the Torah, has lots of rules, and then the rabbis have lots more rules, oftentimes as safeguards, protections, or different reasons why, or they're part of a tradition that came from Moses to the rabbis. But there's rabbinic rules and biblical rules. When there's a biblical rule, the way Jewish law works is that it's much, we observe it very strictly. When it's a rabbinic rule, there's oftentimes room for maneuvering within the rabbinic restrictions. So the first question is, is there a biblical category that my assistants, I'll just use me as an example, but I'll pretend I'm a healthcare provider. I'm a chaplain, not a healthcare provider in that way, but let's just say me, I'm playing healthcare provider today, and I don't want to assist in one of the interventions that we mentioned before, but I have to be able to say, if I'm basing this on Jewish law, why not? What's the category of Jewish law? So the category of Jewish law that the rabbis place us under is a biblical verse in Leviticus 19:14. You shall not curse a deaf person. You shall not place a stumbling block before the blind. So obviously the verse does not just prohibit tripping blind people, because I mean, that's pretty disgusting. If anyone goes around tripping blind people, that's obviously prohibited. I mean, who would tripping blind people? But the Torah says, don't trip blind people. So the rabbis said, no, you're not understanding. It's much more detailed and much more nuanced. It's two prohibitions. One prohibition is giving bad advice. Giving bad advice is considered placing a stumbling block before the blind because it's like informational blindness. Someone doesn't know what they're doing. It's not just bad advice, meaning I give people bad advice all day. But it means bad advice that you know is bad advice. Meaning, let's say someone asks me, you know, how do I get to the Beverly Center from here? And they're like, oh, you know, just go to the 405 and go south. Okay, that'd be bad. That'd be obviously bad. I'm just trying to get them lost. So that's putting a stumbling block before the blind because they don't know where they're going and I'm tripping them up. The other aspect that this law prohibits is facilitating or causing one to transgress the Torah. And this is where the rabbis have said, oh, this is where it becomes an issue, assisting in procedures that violate the Torah. Even if I'm not doing the procedure, I'm the healthcare provider, and I'm not the one engaging in any one of the given procedures that I mentioned today, whether it's one of the hot button topics like abortion or physician aid in dying, I'm not doing it, but I'm assisting someone else in doing it, so therefore I'm putting a stumbling block before the blind. For example, the rabbis gave a couple of interesting examples. One example, actually, is an interesting example. There was a woman in the Talmud that is quoted frequently in medical ethics. She's the woman who was the assistant to the author, the editor of the entire Mishnah, who, when he was dying and suffering and his students were praying for him to live, she smashed the vase on the ground to make them stop praying so that he could die because he was suffering so much. She had this insight. She lived in this house. So there's a story that a man was beating his adult son, hitting him. And she yelled at him, stop it, it's forbidden. And he said to her, oh yeah, what verse prohibits me from hitting my son? And she said, don't place a stumbling block before the blind, because guess what? He's going to turn around and beat you back up soon. And that's prohibited, to beat up your parents. So since that's forbidden, it's forbidden to hit him in the first place. See the logic? Because you're causing someone to do something that's forbidden. Another example. Let's say someone has made a vow not to drink wine. This is a category in Jewish law. There's people who make this vow, but you can imagine in our society, right? Let's say someone's a recovering alcoholic. Someone has a vow not to drink wine. So for me to go up to them and pass them a cup of wine and say, here you go, that's prohibited because I'm putting a stumbling block before the blind. I'm causing someone to do something that violates their vow, right? So this shifts. The point here is that it shifts the focus from my moral commitments as the healthcare provider to the results of my actions. What are the results of my actions cause? And this leads to a huge leniency because, in general, yes, I cannot give the person who vowed not to drink wine a cup of wine. I'm causing it. The result of my actions, they're going to drink wine. But the Talmud says that's true if, let's say, for example, there's some kind of barrier between that person and the wine, like a river. And that person can't reach the wine without me. And then I bring it to them and say, hey, here, I know you wanted that wine, you vowed not to drink it, but you couldn't reach it, so I'm going to bring you the wine. And here you go, now you're able to do it. So the rabbi said, that is putting a stumbling block before the blind. This person could not have access to wine, and now I gave it to them. But what if they did have access? What if they could have done it anyways without me? The rabbi say in that case, no, it's not prohibited to give someone access to something that they already had access to. However, the rabbis did prohibit it. So this is where the discussion gets a little complicated, but this is the main point. The rabbi said, if you have access anyway, so now my giving you the wine, or whatever it is, did not enable the sin, because you could have done it anyways, it's allowed. Except the rabbi said, you can't do it. Unless there are certain specific situations that are happening, then even the rabbis would allow it. Is that clear? The rabbis prohibited it, but only sometimes. So, for example, the rabbis did not prohibit, what if I give someone the ability to have the ability to get to the wine, but I didn't directly put it in front of them? So they say, that's a step removed. So that would be prohibited. What about...
So if you provided a canoe for someone to get to the other side of the wine, right.
But I didn't give it directly. So it's still going to be, it's one step less prohibited. And then it comes to all these cases. Right. So what about, the rabbi said the reason why the rabbis added this prohibition was, the rabbis felt that, a person is supposed to want to prevent other people from doing things that are considered sinful. But what if, I wasn't helping at the moment of the transgression? So if you're not helping at the moment of the transgression, I think I skipped a slide. Yeah. If it's not the moment of the transgression, the rabbi said, it's not prohibited. What if it's happening passively? It's passively allowing someone to transgress. Or what if my livelihood is at stake? The rabbi said, we're not going to require you to lose your livelihood in order to prevent someone from doing something that they could have done anyways. Now getting even more specific. There's another category. This is based actually on a couple of rabbinic stories. Not stories, cases. There was a case of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was considered the greatest decisor of Jewish law in the United States. he was asked, actually it was in London where he was asked, but there was a kosher catering hall that got a request to host an event, that the event was going to have, you know, behavior happening in it that most kosher events don't consider to be appropriate Orthodox Jewish behavior, let's say. And the owners of the hall felt conflicted. Should we rent out our hall to people who are going to do things that don't fit our societal standards or what we think is right? And so they asked him, and they said, should we allow them to rent our hall? So he gave a fascinating answer. First of all, he said, you know, there's a principle that you're supposed to stop someone from sinning. But what if that person doesn't think that what they're doing is wrong? What if they themselves think it's okay? And they're going to do it anyways. I mean, if you don't rent the hall, they'll just rent another hall. And by the way, when they rent that other hall, your hall serves kosher food. The other hall won't serve kosher food, so at least you're allowed to eat kosher food. So he said it would be allowed because they themselves think it's okay. The fact that they think it's okay, you're not required to stop them from doing it. There was another story. I'm not sure if this is going to make sense, but there's a similar story where you know, there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in Israel. So the story goes that someone came to visit him, a leading politician came to visit him, and when he sat down in his house, what do? If someone comes to visit you in your home, a distinguished person, they come, they sit down at your table to meet with you, what's the right thing for a host to do?
Offer them some food.
What if, let's just, you have to look at this from my perspective now, what if from your understanding of Jewish law, a person to eat food shouldn't be wearing a yarmulke, and they should be saying a blessing before they eat the food. But this person is not going to wear a yarmulke. It's a Jewish man. He's not going to wear a yarmulke. He's not going to make a blessing, though. And now what happens when you put the food in front of him? Are you causing that person to sin?
No, you're not causing them to sin, but you're tempting them.
Right, you're not stuffing the food in their mouth. So he offered them food. And afterwards they said to him, how is that allowed? He actually published it later. How is that allowed? He says, because I would have caused them to do another sin if I didn't offer them food. What would that have been? They would have thought, gosh, these rabbis are rude. The rabbis don't know how to deal with people. They don't know how to talk to people. He said, I realize I need to be able to have proper social interaction, and that is more important than the enabling them to do this sin, which they could do anyways. There's one more. You're also going to think this is weird, but I'm being open. Okay, as a Jewish man, so I'm just going to keep talking over it. Shaving with a razor, right? We don't shave our face with a razor. Okay, obviously Jewish law only prohibits a man from shaving their face with a razor. A woman is not prohibited from shaving her face with a razor. I'm not going to shave my face with a razor either way. But what if, just speaking theoretically, I would say, you know what, I have to shave my face with a razor. Why not have my wife shave my face for me, since she's not prohibited from shaving her face, so it's less prohibited for her to shave a face than it is for me to shave. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Right, because it's not prohibited for her, but it's prohibited for me, so let's have her do it. So again, the rabbi said, okay, obviously this is not right. Why is she shaving her face? But she shouldn't do it. But it's less bad for her to do it than for me to do it. So this is the point of this category, which is all what I have on the screen here, which is that if the whole, if I can now summarize, if the prohibition is enabling someone to do something that they couldn't have otherwise done, but then the rabbi said, even if they could do it, it's better not to, but if it's not at the moment they're doing the action, and there's competing alternatives, meaning there's competing values, and it might be better to that they do something with your oversight, so to speak, or that you allow them to do something that they're going to do anyways, it might not be prohibited. And I'll give an example of what I'm talking about. This is an example that comes out in the literature. I remember we listened to this webinar on physician aid in dying when it first became legal in California. In Oregon, it's been legal the longest. They've been doing lots of research. And there was a fascinating study. Okay, every time I quote it, people, you know, ask questions about it. But this is what the study concluded. To me, I think it's obvious. I have it there in small print, but This Professor Gonzini, I forgot her first name at the moment, but she did this study where they asked, you know that not everyone who receives a medication actually takes their life, right? We know this. And so they wanted to try to see if there are there any correlations or maybe even causation between who receives a medication and then doesn't take it. So they wanted to know who's like religious, who describes themselves as being religious. They asked them, and they said, who of your clergy has been involved? and asked them that question. Then they said, was your clergy judgmental and negative about your decision, or are they compassionate and supportive? Not supportive in terms of they were saying, I think what you're doing is great, but just supportive emotionally to you. And they found that those whose clergy were supportive to them, compassionate to them, were then less likely to ingest the medication. They also found that those whose doctor spent the most time talking to them, just talking, hearing them, were less likely. Now, if we're going to use, let's use this as one of our cases. Is it prohibited to assist someone with assisted suicide or aid in dying? I'm using the terms interchangeably because I know different people prefer different sides. I'm trying to be, trying to present this impartially. If you're going to argue that it's problematic to assist someone with ending their life, but what? Let's now walk through all these situations. Let's say I'm, I don't know, what category do I want to say? Let's say I'm their doctor. Let's say I'm the patient's doctor. And they now ask me about it. If I say, you know what, I don't want to talk to you about this. I'm just leaving. I'm just walking out of the room. What's going to happen instead?
Another doctor
will come, right? So let's say, okay, so now we're not in the biblical prohibition. But the rabbi still said, don't help someone do something that you think is prohibited. Okay, but now let's ask the next question. Am I helping them do it at the moment that they transgress? No. Is it possible that if I am a compassionate, supportive healthcare provider, that I can help the end of their life happen in a more positive manner? So the argument, and this is the argument that Rav Asher Weiss made. Now, here was the question that we asked him. In Canada, for example, more than assisted suicide is allowed, right? It's basically euthanasia is legal there. And not only that, but physicians are required to make an effective, direct referral. So many physicians felt, wait a second, isn't this aiding and abetting? Aren't I now assisting in the process of someone ending their life? So this was the question we posed to him. We said, well, let's say here it's not quite as severe, but there was also that discussion at that time of the End of Front Life Options Act, where perhaps a physician or healthcare provider would have to give a patient all their options. Could one give them their options? So we asked this rabbi, who is an ultra-Orthodox rabbi, you know, what do you think? And we kind of thought it was going to be obvious. Like, this is horrific, this is immoral, this is wrong, don't do it, right? A conscientious objection, as we discussed. And he got up here, and so we have it on video also, and he said, not only can you do it, I think you should do it. Well, that was kind of shocking. We should do it? So obviously he had to explain himself, because he's not saying this is a great mitzvah and we should all be trying to do as much as we can. What was his point, though? His point was as follows, and I think it's a very important point, and maybe I'll even tell you a story to try to illustrate. His point was, let's say, now I'm going to put myself in the shoes. The first part of the presentation, I tried to give you impartially, you know, the argument in secular literature in favor of conscientious objection, then the argument against conscientious objection. Now I'm going to let's put myself in the shoes right now, as I'm going to say these words, as a religious Jew who thinks that aid in dying is wrong. Let's just say that. So now I have a patient who I'm supporting, and now I have this option, right? They're asking about this. So what are my choices now? Either I can just step out and pull back and say, you know what, conscientious objection is allowed by the church amendment, right? I'm going to invoke this right, and I'm just going to step out. Oh, you know what, I got a phone call, I'm so sorry, I'll be right back, and then I just never come back, right? Let's just say that's going to be my approach. So what's the patient going to do? As we said, they're going to just find someone else, and they're going to do it anyways, and you know what? They're probably going to be a little bit annoyed. And we know that the number one reason, at least out of Oregon, that people engage in aid in dying is because they want to have a sense of control. And these are often patients who can become easily offended over those who try to take away their control and influence them to go against their own values. So this person is now going to be annoyed and upset, and maybe the person who comes to support them now is going to be someone who thinks, and remember, I'm talking from a certain perspective now, so just hear me out from this perspective. The person who's going to come is going to think, you know what, I think it's good. I think it's good for them to end their life. You know, anyways, there's environmental problems. I'm not saying everyone says this. I'm just giving extreme examples. And why do we need another person for? And they're going to, so I'm giving extremes. I know I'm giving extreme right now. And so now did I do a good thing from my perspective? Or would I have done a good thing if I would have said to the person, you know what, this is what you're asking for? You know what, let me pull up a chair. talk to me. Tell me more about why you're choosing this. Let me hear you out. And really talk it out. And maybe there might be at some point, you know, I'm not saying that the doctor's role is going to be to protest or to say to them, you know, you're immoral, and, oh, well, I could give it to you, but you know you're going to go to hell. You know, I'm not saying that we're going to say anything like that, God forbid, but I'm saying they could talk to them in a way that might be beneficial for them to hear. And maybe, let's say, if we go into the chaplain role, then maybe someone might say, you know, could you tell me a little bit about what our, let's say we're saying religion, what does our religion say, or what do other people say? What do people say about this? Like, maybe we could actually have a conversation. And from that perspective, now, I'm not going to be the one actually ending the person's life. That changes the categorization in Jewish law, right? But to be the one with the person, providing support, support meaning emotional support, maybe I'm actually doing a good thing. This could be in lots of areas, right? I mean, I'll mention more, but it's, you know, I don't know, I guess we're just going to get controversial. I don't know if there's any way around it, but I mean, if we just mention briefly abortion, we know what happens when people aren't allowed to engage in abortion legally. They oftentimes do things that hurt themselves very badly. So is it beneficial? I'm just asking as a question. If someone's going to do something anyway, so let's say we've determined that, to help them to do something in a less bad way, might that be in their best interest? And part of the argument here that Rabbi Weiss made is that, you know, if we go back to the moral diversity argument that we made at the beginning, right? One of the arguments was, you know, we should allow conscientious objection because we believe in moral diversity. We want to have a healthcare system that has all kinds of people. Those who think have a certain set of moral values and those have different sets. And we want to have a robust discussion, right? So if we want to have people in the healthcare system who have concerns about some things, you know, in a respectful way, if we just say to them, you know what, just object to everything you don't want to do. Just pull back. Or don't practice medicine at all. You know what I mean? I'll just tell you a story. I'll tell you a story, even though it's going to give me trouble. So, okay. Here, should I tell it or not? Okay, here's what happened. I'm okay with telling you. You'll give me feedback after an official steward. But, so we had a case. With and the truth is they're very public about this. I'm still not going to say their name or any identifying details, but they afterwards were very public about it. Of a patient who had a severe heart attack, Orthodox Jewish patient, they had a severe heart attack, and they didn't think there was any chance of recovery. The family came in, they said, we want to do everything to save his life, so they said, okay, we'll try. He ended up on ECMO. And after 6 days of ECMO, there was no noticeable recovery. So they had a family meeting in which the team's goal was to make it clear to the family that this patient was not going to survive, and I had to start talking about end of life. So in the meeting, the particular doctor in the meeting kept on saying, you know, after studies all show that for 7 days of ECMO, if no one has improved, if there doesn't be recovery for 7 days, there's not going to be recovery. He kept on saying that. He told me before the meeting, I need you to help get it clear to them that he's dying. They'll hear it from you, they're not hearing it from you. But in the meeting, I kept on hearing him say, it's been 6 days. After 7 days, there's no chance of recovery. So at a certain point, a family member of the patient starts begging, explaining why they so desperately needed him to live. And it was very tear-jerking. And they then turned to me and said, Rabbi, why don't you explain? Like, they didn't, no one else wanted to tell her that he was dying. And so I said, you know, if you're leaving this to me, you know, I keep hearing you say 7 days, and it's been 6 days. I think, you know, we should keep, it was a Friday, remember, so we should keep praying and hoping and supporting the family, and let's keep reconvene on Monday, and if there's no improvement, we'll have to have a very serious conversation then, but for now, I think we should keep trying. That's what I think. And they were not happy with me for doing that, because I went against what they wanted me to tell them, he's dying. So miraculously, or whatever, you know, Monday came, I was anxiously waiting to find out how we're going to handle this conversation, and there were some signs of recovery. So I thought, maybe it's wishful thinking. The doctor said, it is, but let's, you know, don't get your hopes up. Basically, to make a long story short, by Wednesday, he was interactive. Friday's out of the ICU. The next week, he was released from the hospital. And it was really incredible. I thought, wow, look, we really pushed to keep him alive. And in this one case, obviously many times, that doesn't happen. He survived. So why am I telling you the story? Right after that, someone came to meet with me who was applying for a fellowship with our cardiac device team. ultra-Orthodox Jew. And her concern was, she was there with her husband. She has a passion for cardiology, and she wants to work at Cedars-Sinai. Obviously, right? Best in cardiology. But her husband keeps telling her, how can you work in cardiac devices? There's too many of these questions of what we call misayeya, putting something like before the blind. You're going to have to be involved with ending people's lives. So she said to me, so we want to know, what do you think? Because he's kind of convinced me. So I started telling the story, and I said, I'm just curious. I want to do an experiment. What would you have said at that moment on the sixth day? She said, I would have said, 6 days too early to start giving up, and we should keep trying. Okay, at a certain point, you have to have a serious conversation, but what was the rush? I said, we need people like you. We need people that have this perspective. We need all perspectives, not only. So she said, but I have one big problem. I'm going to be involved with people, ending people's lives. How can I do this? So I started explaining this perspective. Her husband didn't accept what I was saying. He said, I don't know, this sounds extreme when you're saying you're a rabbi. He said, who'd you hear this from? So I said, this is what I've learned from Rav Usher Weiss. He said, if I heard it from him, I would accept it. So I said, let's try it. We called him on my phone, at my office on a speakerphone. He answered, and we had a conversation. And she was convinced, and so was he. And his point was, obviously, you cannot do anything that ends someone's life. You cannot, in yourself, actively end someone's life. But when it comes to a whole host, what happened? Oh, did I have this circuit flag the whole time? Oh, there you go. A whole host of interventions, like perhaps writing prescriptions. Is writing prescription causing something to happen at that moment? Is it something that wouldn't have happened without you? Sharing information or options? Serving on boards. What if there's a board? Let's say you have a moral objection to abortion, but there are boards which decide, in some places, moral permissibility. Can you serve on a board that will sometimes say, yes, it is permissible? How about writing DNR orders, or being involved with hospice, or providing anesthesia? This is one of the examples he gave during his presentation. Providing anesthesia during an abortion procedure. Some people feel like, oh, no, I can't be... In one of the articles I was reading, they were saying that people should object even to setting up the operating room, meaning the technicians that set up the operating room. So, okay, I think that's a little extreme, but I understand where they're coming from. But this perspective is trying to argue that there's a whole lot of procedures that we can be involved in, and you know what? Maybe, just put yourself in the shoes of someone who thinks that they're even wrong, morally. But maybe it's not bad for you to be involved, because that's the only way you're going to be able to be involved in healthcare. Because if you think everything's too wrong, and too big of a question, and too hard to justify, then you just have to say, like those who preach what I call, what they call, the incompatibility thesis, and say simply, those who object cannot practice medicine. Maybe they're right, and if you just can't practice, then our bad voice, I don't want to say our, I want to try to, you know, those who have this perspective, they're just going to have to say, okay, let others practice medicine, and I'm just not going to allow my voice just won't be heard. But this perspective, and I'll just conclude with this, and I want to hear your thoughts. This perspective says it's not about moral integrity. We should protect moral integrity. We should protect moral diversity. We should protect people's right to object. And sometimes, even within this approach, people will have to object, right? Because I'm still saying, according to this approach, that directly doing something that's prohibited by Jewish law, to be the one doing it is still prohibited, obviously. But to be involved in an ancillary way, as long as the person can do it anyways without you, and you're not the one actually doing the action, it shifts the focus from the practitioner's morals to what's going to happen, what's the result of my action. And maybe sometimes, this perspective argues, being involved with procedures that even if you find them to be somewhat morally problematic, is still better than not being involved with them. Maybe I'll give some more examples, but I want to hear reactions, thoughts. If you want to throw anything at me, just warn me first.
So Jason, in terms of the way that you've presented this, which I think I follow, you can't be directly involved. As you go down from one step of indirectly to two-step indirectly to three-step indirectly, as you get more and more indirectly involved, it's more and more justified.
Right.
Right? So if it is only one step, if there's a way to not do it, is that then, just in terms of the rabbinic structure of the arguments, if there's a way to avoid being one step, but there's not a way to avoid being second step, can you avoid being one step removed? You see what I'm saying? Are there times where you can still conscientiously object? Because it's not direct. You're still in the indirect now. But but there are ways in which if I'm too close, that's like direct. So, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
you really have to always conscientious objectors. I'm just saying that it's required less and less, and if there's a need to be involved. Obviously, if someone says, you know what, I'm not comfortable with this, and I don't have to get involved, so I'm just not going to get involved. Like, obviously, that can be justified. It's really case by case. I mean, I'll give you another example of a very close, like, one step removed. I asked, one of the questions I asked Rav Osher Weiss in Jerusalem, I asked this question in his home when I first started working here, was, is it problematic? You know, one of the frequent calls we get as chaplains is someone's going to be terminally extubated. And there are times when Jewish law says that that's not allowed, right? Many times when Jewish law says it's not allowed. But the people are not calling to ask, is it allowed by Jewish law? They're calling to say, could the rabbi please come and say prayers? And please let us know when the rabbi's coming, because we're going to time it based on when the rabbi comes, because we're going to do it right after the rabbi gets there, because we just need that's the last step. So it's sort of like I'm causing it in a way. I'm not causing it, but I'm causing the timing of it. Maybe I should get lunch first, or should I walk really slowly so I can live a little bit longer, or can I go at all? You know, there was actually a story in the rabbinic tradition that happened about 150 years ago in the city of Brisk, a famous rabbinic town, where a Jew was taken unjustly and put into jail, and they were going to kill him. And they said, you get one last wish. And he said, I want my rabbi to come at least say my final prayers with me. So they went to get the rabbi, and they said, Rabbi, you're being summoned. They're going to kill this person, this Jew from your community, as soon as you come. So please come so that we can then kill him. So he said, okay, yeah, I'll be right there. And then the next day, they're like, Rabbi, what's going on? He said, oh, yeah, just up soon. The next day, Rabbi, what's going on? We're busy people. He said, oh, yeah, I'm busy too. I'm sorry, I'll get there. They're like, you know, this rabbi's not coming. So some people say, you know what, you can't. That's part of assisting, because he's going. So I asked Rabbi Weiss, can I go? So he told me a very emotional story. He said, there's a someone in his community who has been suffering his whole life. He's paraplegic. He's living on a vent, on a trach. And he's had a very difficult life, and he asked him to come see him one day. He goes to see him, and he says, Rabbi, I want to ask your permission to end my life. I just need to remove the trach. I'll be gone. I can't live like this anymore. So the rabbi said, obviously, I can't. It's against Jewish law. I can't. I'm really sorry. I feel for you, and I understand, but I can't give you permission that Jewish law is going to say this is allowed. He said, I knew you would say that, Rabbi. So my real question is, I'm going to do it anyways. Will you just pray for my soul after I do it? So he realized, I'm in a bind now, because now I'm just one step. I'm giving him permission in a way. If I say yes, I'll pray for your soul, I'm sort of saying to him, yeah, you can do it. He just asked me in a one step removed way. So he thought about it, and he said, yes, of course I will pray for you. And he says to me, you never know how people are going to react when they're suffering, when they're in under stress. He said, if I would have said no, I won't pray for you, would he have... He would have done it. He would have just been mad at me. But instead, I said, I hope you won't do it. But if you do, I'll pray for you. He said, it's been 5 years now. He hasn't done it. And I believe when you show compassion, when you're there. So he said to me, you should go. Go. You're not there as they're telling them it's okay. You're there to provide support, emotional support, spiritual support. And maybe they're going to ask you, you know, for burial advice or funeral advice. And maybe you can actually help them do other things in a religiously appropriate manner. You'll be able to have a good influence. So therefore, you should go in. I think that's an example of a one-step removal. But it's all case by case. What other reactions do you have? Comments? Disagreements? No one disagrees. Right? You're not allowed to disagree with the rabbi, also that's another rule. The rabbis say, you're disagreeing with the rabbis. This rabbi says. I'm joking. Yes,
I'm just curious, if everything is a case-by-case situation, how is that beneficial and expeditious in terms of setting policy and rules?
Well, first of all, I mean, there are a lot of policies. I mean, we have lots of examples of things that can be allowed. Most of this stuff is not emergency. Most of the time. Sometimes it is. The person has to be prepared. It's sort of like there's a joke. When they would give the rabbis their rabbinic ordination, oftentimes on the back of the sheet, there'd be a phone number. People are like, what? No, they say, this is the rabbi's phone number. You're ordained now, but when you have a difficult question, here's who you call. You know, so sometimes people joke also, like some doctors say, I'll put my rabbi's number on my diploma, and you have to sometimes check. But if you can figure out the principles, at least, hopefully if there's an urgent situation, you can figure out how to... we've had cases here where I've been in the emergency room, literally, that people have asked me a question, and in the emergency room, we've gotten rabbis on the phone and made decisions pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Other comments? Yes.
A little hesitation.
I says things that I regretted.
I believe in the state of California, first day contraceptive, next day contraceptive.
Yeah.
Rushes into the pharmacist, and the pharmacist says, no, I don't have tampering.
Right.
But you can go next door, and you can pick it up from your
competitor. Yeah.
Or the answer is, there isn't anybody within 50 miles of
the car. Right.
There's a difference there. So it's a situational type of thing for which there's going to be a different answer
right. And
probably a different way of dealing to it.
Right, and there are people who would say, you are not allowed to say, go next door. And there's cases, very sad cases in the literature, people who have gone to the pharmacist in front of a long line of people for a very difficult medication to ask for and been told, sorry, we don't serve that here. And they say, okay, where can I go? And they'll simply say, I have no idea. Have a nice night. And there is that perspective. I think this perspective is arguing that maybe it would be better to sit down with the person and talk to them and provide the information that they need and in a compassionate and supportive way, and hoping that maybe, you know, there's a benefit in them feeling that they have someone that they can trust and talk to.
But if there is nobody next door.
Yeah, that's common. There's a lot of places.
As a pharmacist to give that person.
By American law, they're protected. A pharmacist can say, I'm not providing this, and it's too bad that you have to fly 3 hours to the nearest place that you need.
But that doesn't make it ethically correct.
No, I'm just saying what's legally protected.
No, from your standpoint, the arguments you use here, you think we can...
This is an argument, logic that you could use in the Jewish law to justify why you would give the prescription.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The same thing if... I don't want to misquote Gerard.
Yeah.
But if it's needed to not practice the Sabbath, to break your rules of the Sabbath, there are reasons why you can do that, not the least of which is if somebody's going to die as a result.
Right.
So there are rules to cover what you're
already... Right. There's always nuances and details.
There's three things, right?
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
So I'm just thinking of... the basis of all of this was not to put the stumbling block before the blind. And the way you've presented this, part of what I hear is, in certain circumstances, what you're trying to do is to see if you can make the blind see. In other circumstances, it's to shorten the stumbling block. I'm just wondering if there are arguments in terms of, you are getting this from a source who has not yet published, and so the full argumentation is not unpacked.
Well, I've read it. I mean, he wrote it, and he shared it with me, but it just hasn't been actually published yet.
Right, but so it could alter. Until it's published, you don't know exactly how it will be finalized.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, is there some kind of basis in the thinking that is appealing to how to alter the primary rationale that says you're not to put a stumbling block before the blind? Because when you talk about, well, show compassion, and then the example is, because I went and I prayed with the man, and it's 5 years now, and he still hasn't stopped it. Part of what you could interpret that as is, he was blind, and now he sees. So he had a, so to speak, a conversion. He saw things differently before he didn't see him. So it looks like you're altering things so that the prohibition is still the prohibition, and what you've done is you've acted in a way to get out of that prohibition.
So here's my argument. Here's how I wrote it in my paper. I think his point is also. And it's possible that I'm misquoting, and Dr. Lieberg, you'll either help me say it privately or they just mean what you think, or publicly. I'm curious. What the point is that we believe that the practice of medicine, whether that is nursing, physician, pharmacy, chaplaincy, social work, ethics, whatever that might, it is an art form and a beautiful opportunity to help people who are vulnerable and in need and to save lives, and it's an incredible chance to make the world a better place. Now, having said that, it is a shame if there are things that are happening that preclude people who want to make the world a better place from being able to provide their support and their interventions. So we want to minimize the amount of times when a person should say, I can't be involved with this because I find it to be morally problematic. So we want to enable healthcare professionals to be able to provide support to patients, even if what the patient's doing is, from their perspective, wrong. But I can still be there for you, and non-judgmentally, at least outwardly, using the word wrong and non-judgmental in the same sentence, I understand, by saying, even though I might say, in my moral system, what you're doing is wrong, if you would ask me yes or no, I would say no. But still, I'm going to provide compassionate, non-judgmental support to you and be there for you, because I believe that the practice of medicine is an opportunity to help people and make the world a better place, and it would be a shame if I had to say, I'll practice medicine, but not in this and that case. So it's trying to widen the playing field of that a person that has these conscientious objections can still not object and be part of the healthcare team, and hopefully that will even have positive impact.
So in the case that Sir just mentioned, where the rabbi helps the blind see, what if the outcome was, yes, I would pray for your soul, said great, then ends his own life? What can you play out the, and that was a good because? Like, not that it was good because then he didn't end his life.
What meaning, obviously, the rabbi hopes he's not going to end his life. But imagine the difference of an end of life of a person who leaves this world thinking they've been rejected by their religious community and that they are being condemned, versus the end of life of someone who feels that they have the support and compassion and love of their religious community. Obviously, you can feel, I wish he didn't do it, I'm sad he did it, but I'm happy that I was able to be kind and supportive to that person. That's right.
In your example before, we're talking to a pharmacist, and one says, well, you can go next door.
Right.
And the other one says, no, I'm not going to help you. Couldn't you say to that person, isn't it a sin to lie? Because obviously, if it's being sold next door, he wouldn't know it. And if he says, I have no idea, he's lying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not sure if it's a sin to lie or not, but you're saying you had an earlier question. You answered the question.
No, I don't think that's the issue.
What do you think?
I don't think, the issue of truth telling is in medicine is an interesting discussion in and of itself.
Yeah.
Doctors don't always tell the truth, and sometimes rightfully so. And, even though we live in a society where everybody has to, we think it's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but we think it's in the benefit for the patient, we'll sometimes couch things in a way that maybe not 100%, but you want to get a result that's beneficial. As far as all this is concerned, I don't see the controversy, actually.
Okay.
This is like, like ABCs in a lot of parts of children.
Yeah.
This issue of the idea of putting the blind is an interesting commandment, because if you actually put a stumbling block in front of a blind person, that's not the commandment you would be not doing that.
Right.
That actually putting a stumbling block has nothing to do with that verse.
Right.
It's giving bad advice,
right,
or in all the other cases. And in Code of Jewish Law, what I think Rabbi Weiner has done is given you a lot of the background and a lot of the discussion. But if you were to go through the Code of Law, it's pretty ABC. And this is, I had opportunity to actually speak on a number of these cases, personal cases that I had in Cedars, with Rabbi Yosef, who was the halachic size for me in the world until he passed away. And it was like open and shut.
Uh-huh.
It had to do with sitting on committees that made policies where my name would be associated with that committee. It had to do with some of the bioethics consultations that we used to do. And this was like, this was not controversial at all.
Good.
So it's not good. Either looking at it like, oh, it's such a terrible
thing. Okay, good. I'm glad you should. Yeah. Good.
And so it is now a little past one, and so we do have to stop. So, of course, Rabbi Weiner will stay here as long as anybody wants to talk to him, but thank you all for coming.
Thank you.